Welcome to our Women's Roundtable podcast, a co-production of the Forward's Women's Issues blog, The Sisterhood, and the Jewish feminist magazine, Lilith. I'm Gabrielle Berkner, web editor of The Forward. I'm here today with Forward editor Jane Eisner.
Hi, Gabby.
With Lilith editor Susan Wiedemann-Schneider.
Hello.
And with Lilith's new associate editor, Sonia Issard.
Hi.
Today we'll be talking about a proposed reality series about self-proclaimed Jewish American princesses. We'll also be looking at the evolution of the game of Mahjong and the high demand for Jewish donor eggs. But we're going to begin by discussing a new organization called In Shifra's Arms. It's a group that bills itself as the first crisis pregnancy center geared towards Jewish women. And a recent Washington Jewish Week article about it has caused a firestorm in the feminist blogosphere. Crisis pregnancy centers, if you're not familiar with the term, are not your run-of-the-mill women's health clinics. These centers push an overtly anti-abortion agenda, and many, if not most of them, are funded by or affiliated with the Christian right. The Jewish community, while inarguably heavily pro-choice, is not a monolith. Susan, so do you think In Shifra's Arms, which says it can help pregnant women stay in school, find jobs, obtain supplies, does it fill any niche in the Jewish community?
My thought when I read the article and have tuned into what's going on in the blogosphere and looked pretty carefully at the website of In Shifra's Arms is that they are incredibly naive and in many ways condescending to particularly to the young women they're targeting. They're going out and speaking first person to high school students at a Jewish day school in Washington, to university students there. The idea that they that by telling women you can, you know, add elastic to your pants and have maternity clothes, and if you don't want to have the embarrassment of staying in college pregnant and going to classes, they'll find you an internship, and without even the remotest notion of what it might be like to face an unwanted or an unplanned pregnancy without financial resources and without all sorts of other supports that they don't even allude to on their website. So I don't think that it fills any real niche.
What I worry about is the growing trend in America, and I'm sure the American Jewish community is not immune to this, to not feel supportive of abortion rights. And I think it's something that those of us who believe women should have a right to choose whatever they want to choose, I think we need to take this a lot more seriously. I think the messages are not getting across. I think it's for reasons that have to do with, you know, the funding and the strategy and the politics of those who are not pro-choice, who say they're pro-life. But I also think it has to do with changes in society that, to some degree, we welcome. There's no stigma anymore to having a child out of wedlock. And there's no stigma to not marrying beforehand or even to having a child on one's own. And while personally I would never tell a woman in any circumstance that she shouldn't have a child that she wants, I also am very familiar both personally and academically with the data. You know, the data shows that children are best raised in a happy, healthy family with both parents or the best surrogate that one can find for that.
Do you guys see the recent study? I think I saw it in Time magazine, that children raised by two mothers, you can cue the two Jewish mother jokes now, were actually more well-adjusted and had fewer behavioral problems than children raised by heterosexual parents. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. But I think we also have to recognize that even though we welcome gay families, that's never going to be the norm. I mean, in that it's never going to be the majority of people. Just like I don't think the crisis in marriage is caused by gay marriage. I think it's a crisis in heterosexual marriage. I also think that it's heterosexual families that have to really figure out how we're going to both keep options and be tolerant of different choices, and yet also do what I believe is best for children.
It seems to me pregnancy and childbirth and child rearing ought to be taken a little more seriously than the Jews on the right, shall we say, are putting out. That it's doing a tremendous disservice to young women who rather naively may be susceptible to this message that the community will stand behind you, that this is that you can have the phrase in this particular website was you can have a great life and still be a mother.
I mean, she's adopting so much rhetoric from the Christian right, and I think acknowledges that. But I think one of the things that's interesting about having this be a specifically Jewish organization is I think that a lot of times, at least for me, it's easy to really bracket anti-choice activism or people that are really challenging the woman's right to choose by saying, oh, you know, they're sort of over there somewhere. We don't really have to consider what the implications are for our community. And I think that maybe one of the things that good that can come out of this sort of episode of dealing with this organization is really remembering that we have to stay vigilant about making sure that we're being vocal and being articulate about defending those rights and those options.
I have no doubt that if you were to take a serious poll today of young Jewish women, Orthodox and not Orthodox, that the acceptance of bringing an unplanned pregnancy to term, or rather the rejection of abortion, would be much higher than it would have been 20 years ago.
Really?
And like I said, because I think the stigma's over.
Now at 31, abortion just seems much more fraught. Like the decision to have one would be much more fraught than at, you know, 18 or 21, when it seemed like the real obvious choice for a woman facing an unplanned pregnancy. And seeing friends miscarry or have trouble conceiving or can't afford to adopt, or, you know, there's a long waiting list to adopt, it's made it just a more loaded question, mm-hmm. for me at least.
Well, and remember, theoretically, these crisis pregnancy centers are encouraging adoption.
Right.
And since there are so many people who want to adopt, then, you know, there should be a way in which this can help facilitate growing new families.
Well, I mean, that's the argument also in favor of Jewish women's eggs being solicited, shall we say, in the pages of campus newspapers. But I also think that certainly this website and the people who've commented on it, there's no sense at the other end of actually making a match between families who, for a variety of reasons, want to adopt and these scores of as yet unborn children. They've been in business for about a year, this website, and so far have seen one woman through an unplanned pregnancy. It's not as if there are, you know, hundreds or thousands of women turning to them.
Susan, you mentioned the high demand for Jewish donor eggs, and on a related topic, 10 years after it was first proposed, Israel's parliament, the Knesset, recently passed legislation that eases the really tight restrictions that Israel has long had on egg donation. And that'll arguably make it easier for women who want Jewish donor eggs to get them. Over the years, both Lilith and The Forward have reported on the growing market for Jewish donor eggs. What do you know about why Jewish eggs are in such high demand, Susan?
Well, I think that demographically, Jewish women stay in school and college and in graduate school much longer than women of other groups, certainly in the West. And we are the latest to marry. And if typically at least the majority of people having children are having children in a marriage, all of this means that procreation is put off later and later. And there is some age-related infertility that starts to click in. So Jewish women are at 35 or 40 or 45, looking to women like themselves for eggs. That is, they're looking down the age spectrum and looking for women who are 25 and also have high SAT scores and, you know, play Mozart on the piccolo. And so they're looking for women like themselves if they're going to be the wombs that will gestate their children.
We had a story about a year and a half ago in the paper that was really interesting and disturbing, talking about this trend of the Israeli women coming here and being paid for their trouble. And it is trouble. It is hard
indeed.
To do this.
And the risk is often minimized, by the way, to the egg donors.
Exactly.
They don't quite understand what that process will be like for them.
And it's not that I don't think that they should be compensated, but you are basically then turning this egg into a commodity. And so there's just the opportunity for abuse or corruption, or at the very least, just taking advantage of people who are so vulnerable, either so needy to be able to make the money to do this, or so desirous of having a Jewish egg that they'll go to great lengths to do so.
Well, and it raises interesting class issues as well. When you were saying before, Gabby, about the high cost of adoption, the high cost of in vitro fertilization mm-hmm. comes into play as well. And where Israel, which has always been very pronatal, will support through the medical insurance a large number of tries at in vitro fertilization.
Right.
Insurance companies here do not. But the class issue, which really kind of rang a bell for me when I did the first piece in Lilith 10 years ago on this subject, was that there were not very many middle-class American Jewish women, like zero. After 3 years, we found one who had actually had her eggs harvested and said mm-hmm. she was doing it, you know, for ethical reasons, to help someone start a family, not for the money. But the Jewish women whose eggs were being harvested and her, who were being paid between $5,000 and $25,000 for this were largely Israeli women out of the army looking to make some money, or mm-hmm. Russian Jewish women who either came here or were recent immigrants. Right. So there, it raises a slew of issues that we might see on the ethical spectrum, if we won't quite label them ethical right. issues, but issues of concern.
Yeah. Right. I mean, in Israel, I guess they pay for all types of assisted reproductive technologies. And in the States, I think only like 11 states mandate that insurance companies do cover reproductive technologies. And so sometimes it can feel like almost like eugenics, like more babies for fit mothers. And what makes a fit mother a mother who can actually pay for in vitro or has the right kind of insurance coverage?
And we like to think that we're not a tribe, but here we have people who want the Jewish egg.
Right. Changing gears a lot. There was a recent casting call. I don't know if you guys saw it on Radar Magazine's website, that saw self-identified Jewish American princesses, or JAPs, for a Jersey Shore-like reality show. As far as I know, the show hasn't been picked up yet. But if it was, would it necessarily be such a bad thing? Sonia, what do you think?
I mean, I certainly don't see too much that would be productive coming out of it. I'm not sure that it's a tragedy.
I'm not sure that the word productive in a reality show has ever been in the same sentence. I don't understand why anybody would even be interested in it. And yet, obviously, it hits a nerve for us because we're, let's be honest, you know, probably, or at least I'll speak for myself, incredibly embarrassed mm-hmm. that this stereotype not just exists as a stereotype, but it's based on countless women and families that we've encountered. And
right.
It's, you know, I think we all have tried hard to raise our daughters as the anti-Jap, but it's out there.
You know, you said you worked hard to try to raise your daughter as anti-Japs, but I spoke with a father recently of two teenage daughters, and he said that he was proud to raise Jappy daughters because it was like not only a yardstick of his own success, but a measure of his daughter's happiness. And of course, I was horrified.
Well, talk about commodification. I mean,
but what did he think of about happiness?
It was a symbol for him that he could provide what his daughters wanted. And he said, you know, if they're princesses, I'm the king. So,
okay, but, well, we know who that's about.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about, did these stereotypes inform how you raised your daughters? I know you have a daughter, Susan, and Jane, you have three.
Well, I actually have two daughters, and each one of them will say to me that she remembers quite vividly when the word Jap was used in my presence. My older daughter describes how I almost drove off the highway when I had one of her girlfriends in the back seat, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things about this stereotype, and I sort of like Jane have this allergic reaction to even hearing that someone is daring to use those words in a casting call, it has about it a sense both of some woman who is entitled and materialistic mm-hmm. and also of someone who is rather brazen and outspoken. You know, this sort of, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. The Jap is the one who wants to be the doctor and who wants to marry the doctor.
Don't you think part of why it's so, you know, such a recurring theme is because it's really a class question, right? It's really a question about money. And as long as questions about Jewish identity and the portrayal of Jews in the media or whatever we're sort of talking about, as long as that's wrapped up with money, it seems like it's sort of a manifestation of that being sort of the more underlying issue.
But it's also because, unfortunately, too many people in our community do worship money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think you could just blame the media for this. Right. I mean, you just have to hear about some of these ridiculous bar and bat mitzvah parties or the gifts that, you know, children get, or the way money is spent, to realize that that still is a value in so many communities. We laud those people who give away a lot of money, no matter how they've actually conducted their private life.
I mean, but do you think it's about the having of wealth, or do you think it's about the sort of
display
of wealth?
You know, Jane, you talk about bar and bat mitzvah parties and this display of wealth, but I think that there's a big piece missing from that, which is that nobody uses these stereotypes in the same way against Jewish boys and men. there is a really pernicious amalgam in the Jap stereotype, which is a melding together of anti-Jewish sentiment or ideation that, you know, all Jews are rich or all Jews are materialistic, and a really powerful portion of misogyny.
I definitely take your point, Susan, but I also think that there's a pretty pernicious stereotype of the nebbishy Jewish man. I mean, Woody Allen has made an entire career exploiting that. So I think that the Jap is a more defined and maybe objectionable kind of character. But
more
I think,
objectionable.
I do think that there's, you know, the flip side of it is, you know, the man who'll be freezing in the restaurant and not say a word, but constantly be trying to catch the non-Jewish girl.
Right. I think it's interesting that the casting call, like, unlike the Jersey Shore, where it's both young men and women, it's just they're just looking for women. And here's what the casting call says. Company looking for super Jappy groups of friends. Women ages 21 to 45 are able to apply for this reality show. Gone are the days when being a Jap was a bad thing. Jewish American princesses are proud. Think Jersey Shore meets Real Housewives of New Jersey, but classier. We want beautiful, fun, outspoken groups of Jewish American women.
Well, I'm glad they think that the days are gone when this is a bad thing.
I don't think the days should be gone where this is a bad thing. So anyway, changing gears again from stereotypes of younger Jewish women to stereotypes of older Jewish women, that is that they play mahjong. We're going to be discussing that Chinese tile game that has become a favorite pastime of Jewish women in America. In a recent issue of Lilith, there was an article about the sociology of the game, and the article coincides with the opening of Project Mahjong at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. What new light does that article shed on the importance of the game in the lives of Jewish women?
Well, actually, the piece that's going to be coming out in Lilith's summer issue, what came to us quite coincidentally, unrelated to the Mahjong show, is the person who wrote it is an architect and designer in Canada who was fascinated by the role that the Mahjong table played in the space of her in-law's living room. It's really a feminist analysis of, was this an empowering experience for women who got to dress up once a week and serve their friends lunch, and the whole family knew this was Maj Day, and the best china was on display. This was a way in the 50s, and I guess it was in the 60s as well, in certain circles, for women to have a role other than their childbearing role in a time when women who could afford to were supposed to be remanded to the home front and not be out working. And the question asked in this piece, au contraire, is this because it's a temporary card table that is set up and put back in the closet after these hours of play? Is this, in fact, a way of reinforcing women's traditional, you know, non-self-actualizing role? So it was actually a rather deep and fascinating look at what goes on in that space.
It's interesting, though, because I didn't grow up with a mom playing mahjong.
Nor I.
But I grew up with parents playing bridge. And my father in particular, who was a very quiet and studious person and worked most of the time, as far as I can remember being a child, his one steady socialization was his bridge club. The three other guys he grew up with since they were, you know, five or something. And they'd play bridge, you know, at different homes. And it would be the same thing. The bridge table would come out, then it would go back. And it does bring you back to a time when entertainment was very inexpensive. All you needed were the mahjong tiles, or all you needed were a deck of cards and some snacks. It was based around a fellowship of sorts with people. And, of course, I'm sure the game ended up being subservient to the conversation, much the way that sometimes now in book clubs, you know, what you're reading is actually irrelevant compared to the conversation you have. But it's interesting to me that there's a kind of a nostalgia for this, or an interest in understanding what it was.
And it's back. It's back. And if you just Google JCC and Mahjong, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of courses being given all across the U.S.
I think it's just wonderful. Wonderful.
One of my favorite stories I've ever written was about when I was covering Joe Lieberman's 2004 presidential campaign. I did a story about his mother, Marcia, of blessed memory, her group of Mahjong ladies who got together, and between them, I think, had upwards of 200 years of Mahjong playing experience. So before I wrap up, I don't know if you guys have heard about this new anthology. It's called Click. It's all different women's stories about when they first knew they were a feminist. So I thought it might be fun for us to go around the table and talk about our own Click moments. Sonia, do you want to start?
Sure. I was actually talking about this at the office yesterday with Susan a little bit, and I want to tweak the question a little bit, if that's okay,
sure.
And talk about the moment when my feminism and my sort of Jewish identity consciousness came together. That's okay. And I was thinking about the first time I read an article by Naomi Seidman, who actually has a fiction piece in Lilith's summer issue coming up. She did sort of a feminist gendered reading in terms of language hierarchy stuff with Yiddish and Hebrew and occasionally English or Russian or other sort of third languages in the long history of Jewish multilingualism. It was just a great moment for me because it felt like she really brought together all of the kinds of tools that I'm really interested in thinking about, which have a lot to do with language and a lot to do with using the tools of feminist theory and feminist analysis. So it felt very like somebody had sort of designed an idea for me, like specifically somebody said, oh, why don't we put together all of these great things that Sonia loves and give them to her in this little package. And so it was a very exciting moment to sort of see the way that the tools of feminist thought and feminist analysis can really, you know, give a new light onto a lot of the sort of historical questions that I had been thinking about, qualities.
Jane?
Wow. I have a much, much more prosaic memory. I mean, I'm just sort of going back. I'm of an age when the desire as a girl to want to have a career, especially a career in journalism, was not common at all. And I always think to myself that I've become a journalist and an editor and been the first woman in so many of the positions that I've held, including the one I held now, in spite of the advisor to my high school newspaper, who was a horrible man. I mean, I wouldn't say that about most anybody, but he truly was. There were only two of us girls who deigned to go into the office of the high school newspaper to try to write for it. And I will, obviously now, you could hear it in my voice, never forget when in front of all the boys called me a stupid adolescent female and told me that I would, you know, never make anything of myself. So I quit the paper and, you know, went on to be the first woman editor of my college newspaper. So it obviously didn't stop me. But, journalism always felt like an uphill battle, starting even from the 9th or 10th grade. And I'm just so happy now that that aspect of it has changed and that we've been able to create here and in partnership with folks like you, Susan, and Sonia Lilith, to, you know, create a journalism that is so much more inclusive.
I gave this after you asked the question, Gabby. I gave it a lot of thought. And it, I must have had blinkers on for much of my life, but I actually don't remember not feeling that I was a feminist. So I don't have a single Click moment where I didn't feel that I could take things on. But I do remember a Click moment where I understood that the changes women can wreak make a difference. And that was when I was living in Israel and I had a one-year-old child and I had 2 degrees. And in the United States at that point, it was very atypical for educated women with young children to work outside the home. I had, for my son's first year of life, worked as a book reviewer from a distance, and that was before telecommuting. And I remember sitting in his playpen with my typewriter because it was fine for him to have, you know, the run of the living room, but I didn't want anybody bothering me while I was typing. And then I went to Israel. And I spent 6 months there when my husband was setting up a lab for Hadassah Hospital. And everyone like me, you know, people who were working, who were professionals, who were teaching at the university, had their children in a gan in daycare in a nursery program. And I dropped my son off every morning, and he had a delightful, you know, 5 hours. And even though in Israel at that point it was expected that the woman of the house was going to be home to make lunch for people at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was assumed that women and men would be working outside the home for pay. The economy required it. Every family required it. Employment was very high. There was no unemployment at that point in Israel. And I came back and something clicked. And I spent many months after that writing and being asked to speak about, you know, compare and contrast the lives of Israeli women and American women. And the fact that available and acceptable quality child care existed in Israel, just it was like the unsealing of my eyes. It was like the doors of perception open. Not only that it was good and that it was available and not expensive, but that it was accepted to use it. So that was my click. Gabby, you're on.
Okay. I was 18, and it was towards the end of my senior year, and we were all gathered around the yearbook office to find out if we had won any of the superlatives, and if so, which ones. And we all looked at the list, and then another woman asked me, "Oh, what did you get?" And I said, "Class feminist." And this is the woman who had won Best Legs said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Don't worry about it." And you know what I said? And you know, I was thinking that we have a category called Best Legs, and she feels the need to apologize to me for winning Class Feminist, which I felt was a reflection of not me talking about women's issues a lot, but really being a leader in the high school. You know, I thought it was something very positive, and it never occurred to me that someone would think otherwise. Although I probably wouldn't have minded winning Best Legs and Class Feminist, since both categories existed. So that's all for today. We invite you to visit Lilith Magazine online at www.lilith.org and The Forward, which is home to our women's issues blog, The Sisterhood, at www.forward.com. Jane, Susan, Sonia, and Sonia, welcome. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gabby.